for.
Okay, I'm Robert Wimble.
And it's May...
May 5th. 1992. I'm Robert Wimble. And it's May 5th, 1992.
One more time.
I'm Robert Wimble.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Well, I was interested in what you started to say about kind of giving me an overview, and you were talking about a part of the town where a lot of Irish settled. I don't know much about Moortown. So any kind of overview is really helpful for me.
Well, the earliest, according to my understanding, the earliest settlement was in the Rock Bridge section, which is over near Duxbury Corners, near Waterbury. And names like the Hazeltines and people like that were the early settlers. But we were, as I said, we were divided up into different sections of the town by the school districts. And over the Northfield Mountain was the Cox Brook section. And there was Jones Brook section was down near Montpelier. And then there was a Flanagan Schoolhouse. It was between Middlesex and Moortown. And of course, the Taplin School was right near the Green Mountain Power Station outside of Middlesex. And, of course, there was the village school, and then there was the common school up on Moortown Common. And earlier, I guess, there was probably a school district over near, up on the South Hill, where the Irish, and I was telling you about Mrs. Reagan that had done the research for that area. And the original Catholic Church was there, it seems like Mrs. Howe said there was something like 16 school districts at one time.
Is that right?
Yeah, which seems like a lot. And there was a school over here beyond us, another school. Now, whether that school that's over there where they have the town has the snow fence and things like that was originally the school here, and then they built this later near the Four Corners, I don't know. But our barn here was built to replace one that had burned in about 1920. And as I understand it, it was built from the original church that was vacated when they built the church in the hollow, which is down in Moortown now. And that was dedicated in 1853. So the building has some age on it, yeah.
Now, how long has your family been on this farm?
Well, we came here in 1945. Mm-hmm. And my mother came to Moortown in 1910. And my dad in 1928. So,
from where?
Well, my mother came from Cambridge. But actually, just...
Cambridge, Vermont?
Yes, but just recently we found, looking up the family tree, that that my great-great-great-grandfather died in Moortown in 1813.
Is that right?
And I don't know that my mother ever knew this.
I'll be darned.
But it's an interesting thing. I think maybe it was the, would they have typhoid fever at that time? I guess there was several outbreaks of this different times. But... this was something we found in the town records. Couldn't find where they live. We were interested in that. But my mother was a maverick in those days. She graduated, I think, from Burlington Business College, which is now Champlain College, way back in maybe 1909 or 1910. So, and she came to work here in the local store, and then she was a bookkeeper for Ward Lumber Company. And see, she went her home that was right near the fire station and blacksmith shop in Moortown. She went through the 1927 flood and the 1938 hurricane. So we were tested, the family was tested by water there. And she lost a brand new car that was in a little garage near the prison library, sat there. And when my dad came to town in 1928, he helped my mother, who was living up where Eunice Ferris lives there, across from the town clerk's office. Mrs. Bates had a boarding house there. And so they both, my mother, because her house had been flooded, she lived there during the winter, and my father came to work in the talc mine. But the talc mine became inoperative, and so as a result, he fell back on his experience as a board sawyer in the sawmill, and so he worked for the lumber company, and they met there in the boarding house. So that's a way that that came about.
The Ward Lumber Company, as I understand it, has been for a number of generations.
Right.
And I think I heard the story, and I don't remember. It was the first ward that came here with just a crosscut saw and an ox team and something.
Well, originally, I suppose that they lived up on what they call Ward Hill up in Duxbury, and I think maybe they had their first mill up in Dowsville.
Uh-huh.
I think that's where originally it started, and I think they came from there down into the village of Moortown as their business expanded and things like that. Yeah. But Will Kingsbury, who was very generous with his time and very understanding, he was their blacksmith. At that time, all the farmers had horses, and the lumber company had horses, and they moved all a lot of their lumber around their yard with horses. And I can remember, as a youngster, before I would get up in the morning, I'd hear the horses go down through cloppity clop clop with their horses, and especially in the wintertime, you could hear the squeaking of the steel. They didn't have rubber tires, they had steel wheels. And they had a lot of these army wagons, I think, that were left over from World War I that they used in the lumber, to move the lumber around. This was before the trucks became as prevalent as they are now. We might have, at the most 20 cars going up and down Route 100 in those days. We'd move our cow. We had a family cow, and another family by the name of Hayes. Richard and I would bring our cows out and bring them up the road, and we would we'd march them from down below where the lower store was up into the library, and we might hold up one or two cars, and we'd even know who they would be. They might be the Commissioner of Agriculture, Ed Jones. He'd be coming back. And so that's how much we've progressed, as far as traffic goes in the community, But anyway, it was interesting for me to see the transition from the blacksmith, where everything was done with horses, and he would make a lot of wagon wheels, repair them, and he would make things out of metal. And he had a forge there, and I used to turn the crank and to make the air to go through to burn the coal. He'd hammer just like an old-fashioned smithy, and Uncle Will Kingsbury. And they even had a place there where they used to shoe oxen. I was too young or too old, born too late to see that done, but there was a place there. So that was just, we lived through that period of time when they used to do that before welding became prevalent. And we went from the, in the wintertime, people would put their car up and they would go to town with their horse and buggy. And a lot of the older people that didn't know how to drive would use horsepower to get where they were going, you know. So, pardon?
Did you have electricity in Moortown?
In the village of Moortown. But up on the hill where in the common, I guess there were a few places that were fortunate that the power company came up over the common and back into the village. So there were farms on the outskirts of Moortown, between Middlesex and Moortown, that didn't have power. And there were many up here until that rural electrification came through REA in 1945 after the war. So many of these farms up here had Delco systems with batteries and of course in the wintertime you used to see the trucks loaded with ice, and the farmers would all have their ice houses and cakes of ice. You'd see that. I don't remember the creamery in operation, but the creamery outside of Moortown, there, the Messer's Creamery was a. I remember of my mother told me that she got the pasteurized milk. I was a little one, and I was born cesarean, and she was what, 44, I guess, when I was born. So I was a bottle baby with Carol syrup and the pasteurized milk. And someone will probably mention Mr. Sweenard, but he was a very lovely French Canadian that came down, and he had cows on the backside of the river before you get to the Carpenter Farm on the right there, and he used to peddle milk with a pickup truck, and it was raw milk, and every day they'd come through the village with their pickup, and he and his family would, as I understand it, they milked their cows by hand, bottled their milk, and sold it. And he was he had a large poultry farm there, and he used to take fresh poultry to the city of Montpelier every several times a week. And it was a favorite pastime of his to go to the movies. So he would go to the movies every afternoon. They got so that it seems like they used to say that he didn't have to pay to go to the movies. They know him so well. And he would go to the Strand Theater or to Capitol Theater. And it was just an interesting pastime. But that was his hobby, you know. And
yeah, I have stories. Well, Earl Fuller used to talk about taking his girl to the movies and coming back at night with his horse, and they'd fall asleep in the horse.
Sure. Well, I was telling you about Andy Newton. Will and Etta Johnson used to live at down at the beginning of the village, and her gift of the popcorn balls at Christmas was a highlight. And of course, in those days, a youngster would get an orange in his stocking or something like that, because you know fruit and vegetables were not readily available in the rural areas like this. So things like that were customary at that time, you know. I'm sure today, if you gave a youngster an orange in his stocking, he would think that you weren't very generous.
It was like a piece of gold.
But that was part of that. But there were, I think I was impressed with way people shared their lives with others in our valley and within our community. I'm sure this went on in all communities in New England, but it was very important for especially during the wartime when travel was limited because of gas rationing, that you used to be able to hitch a ride with a milk truck and go to Waterbury. Today the labor laws would laws would be that liability insurance wouldn't allow you to ride on a truck or things like that. But this is a way that country boys could go to the local larger community and partake in the niceties of it, you know. But things that neighbors used to help neighbors, there would be many people that would give of themselves different ways. Charlie Latimer, the young Methodist minister, he was very interested in sports, and we used to. He had a Boy Scout troop, and then a youth group within the church, and it was sort of ecumenical. They didn't draw any lines because of religion. The youngsters in the community were all his friends, and so we had a local baseball team, and we used to take us to, we'd play basketball after the Waitsfield High School would play theirs in the local. They had, their gymnasium was where the Cabin Fever Quilts is now, next to the Valley Players building. And you'd go there to the watch a Waitsfield High School game, and then as the fire went out, you would play basketball. You'd practice basketball, and the shirts or the skins, and it sometimes was rather cool with just an undershirt on a 10 or 15 below zero night, you know? I don't know, but these are memories that this was our fair of sports in those days for young people, you know. That was back in the early 40s. This sort of thing.
Well, there's been a big change since the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
How big a town was Moortown in those days? I mean, has it grown in some?
I think it's grown some. At the time, seems like census figures were the town report that we had something like 1,000 people of residents. And then we grew to 1,300. I have no idea what it is today.
So it was a bigger town, really, in the valley.
What's that?
It was a fair-sized town for the valley.
Yes. Yes, I think it was probably maybe one of the larger communities. And we were spread out because of our geographic location. Splintered, you might say, because over the mountain, the people went toward Northfield and out toward Montpelier. They were either centered their activities in commercial activities in Montpelier or Middlesex, and Waterbury, Duxbury Corner was down that way.
Well, now, did the Ward Lumber Mill really just affect this part of Moortown over here, or did it affect?
Yeah, I think just mainly this area. They were people that travel some distance to work in those days, but mostly just neighboring communities. Yeah.
Because it's interesting to me, the whole complex of the Ward Lumber Mill and having its own store and everything is quite different than you find in the other valley towns, and it must have, I would imagine, had a big influence.
I would say it did. I would allow perhaps people that worked for the company I think my thought would be that we, at that time, that was a local industry making use of forest products. It gave people an opportunity to make a livelihood, locally. So they didn't have to travel a great amount of miles to reach their work.
And then you told me there was the talc industry.
Yes, yeah.
And that was over toward Duxbury.
Yes, and there was another one that's another talc mine that's probably located in Duxbury. That was in Duxbury, but it's actually between just the beyond the junction of Route 100 and 100B. There was opposite the Church of the Crucified one now. Up in there, there was the talc mine that my dad had come to work in. And actually, he had worked for this gentleman that was brother-in-law of my father's aunt. And he was a logger for International Paper Company over in the Adirondacks. And he had invested $20,000 in the talc mine. Not my dad, but this gentleman by the name of Fred Buschke. And he had come here to try to protect his interest because it was in hard times. I suppose that maybe the talc was running out, or there was a glut in the market, or whatever, you know. But in those days, that was a lot of money. So my dad came into town with just a suitcase, I would imagine, certainly he's been a very, very capable, industrious man all his life here in the community.
Now, he worked for the lumber company after
for a number of years, yeah.
And then
17 years, and then came and bought the farm, yeah, on a shoestring, yeah, through hard work, yeah, frugality, frugalness. We went through from the, you might say, we went from the horses to the machine through that revolution, which is changing times. It's very challenging, you know.
Yeah, I'm interested in that change.
Yeah. So, we used to drive cattle from South Hill, which is up beyond St. Patrick's Cemetery. We'd drive cattle in the spring. They were not ours, but the Ward Lumber Company had a herd of registered Guernseys, and young people that their families may have worked for the company, but we used to drive cattle on foot from up there way up beyond the old fairgrounds, which is, well, we call it the Carey Place, which is way up in north in center Faiston. So it was quite a considerable distance, and we'd drive cattle from up there, also up on the Ward Hill. And you can imagine taking a bunch of cattle, you know, a couple hours. They'd run over everybody's lawn, and it was quite a feat. But we didn't have the traffic that you'd have today, and they didn't have trucks that would want to spend the time to truck them. So we'd run them on foot, you know.
How many of you?
Well, I'm not sure how many. I can't remember how many, but I just remember participating in this, you know. Yeah, it was like the mini marathon, you know, the cattle marathon.
Sure.
Yeah, because the cattle had just gotten out into the spring, and they liked to frolic, and they were young, and maybe they were scared, but it was quite a workout. I can remember people, sometimes they get pretty upset when you'd run a bunch of cattle over their lawn in the spring, you know. Yeah. But up until after the war, there were very many automobiles and very few commercial vehicles, and so much different, you know.
Going from horses to tractors, did you still use horses?
Yes.
For
a period of time as a backup. Yeah, there was some of the original tractors were small, and They weren't very well geared up. They didn't have very much traction. Depending on what model you bought, and they tried to be as economical as they could be. I think that some of the early tractors were small. And in the spring, many times, you know, you'd use your horses to pull the people out of the mud anyway when these roads weren't all that great. And
so you got your first tractor just after the war?
Well, our first tractor we bought, and we had an old Fordson, which was an iron wheeled tractor that was a very hard thing to start, and you cranked it and you could break your arm with it. So we used to use that, but we didn't buy our first tractor until 1951. And it was 4 years old. It was used then. But that was basically after the war was mostly the time when tractors became more prevalent around here.
Well, and you said you bought this place in 40?
Well, we rented it from a gentleman that was by the name of Robert Cairns, that came from Canaan, Connecticut, or down in. And he was, you might say, he was very a person of foresight, because he had come up here and bought a number of these farms as an investment. And so we bought the farm, and we rented the farm from him, and 3 years later we bought it. So we sold our little house in the village there for $1,700, and loaded all our earthly goods on the 1932 Ford truck, farm truck, and came up here with it. And
how many cows did you start with?
Well, not an. I don't know how many cows that they were here in the original herd. Maybe something like 30 or something like that.
And were you milking by hand?
Well, the first winter, I think the water froze up, and I think the cows didn't give any milk, and so I think we did milk by hand. We had two milk machines, and I think everything was so challenging that I think we put the milkers up and milked by hand. So I guess maybe as you realize from seeing the village of Moortown, a lot of the houses had attached barns.
Yes.
That were quite large for a garage, and they were because they had been built at the time when people were dependent upon horses for transportation. And so we had a family cow in the village, and the way of farming was much different in those days. Before we had balers, you know, we had to mow the hay, and even I can remember of some people with small places, they used to do quite a bit of haying by hand with a scythe, you know. But before the baler, we used to use a hay loader or pitch it on by hand. So I think when we came up here in 1945, there was something like 30 farms in this area. And now I guess we're down to two operating farms. And
you and the house?
Yes, yeah.
And have the house been here a long time?
Yes, yeah. Their family would go back many generations, yeah. Yeah, see, I wouldn't have known that except as far as our family, except for the genealogy, and after looking that up, then I realized that our family had been here previously to my mother's coming.
Oh,
1910 or so. But I wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for history.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just discovered that my great-great-grandmother was born in Waterbury.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of forgetting, if the story isn't told and passed on.
But there were things that we did during World War II that I would just share with you. I can remember that we had a scrap drive for scrap metal, and this huge pile of metal was on the schoolhouse lawn, and they had all this old fire machinery, these old mowing machines and rakes and all sorts of everything you could think of. They needed the scrap metal for the war effort, and there was a huge pile on the schoolhouse lawn in the village. And one other thing that we did was school children would take these onion bags and go out on their bicycles and pick the milkweed pods in the fall, and they'd use these for life preservers. The natural, if you've ever seen the milkweed just as it's ready to, it's mature, it's fluffy, and it has this buoyancy that they used to make before they had the modern way of making life preservers. That's the way they made them, or that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So that was one thing I remember from the war. Another thing they...